It is 12, a little bit afternoon here on WFT Champagne 90.1 FM. My name is Ben Theobald. This is the world we live in. I'm going to play an address by John F. Kennedy to kind of get started. There are some kind of issues I really want to talk to you about, but while I get kind of those set up and ready, I want to play a speech or a more of an address that John F. Kennedy gave about church and state. So this is John F. Kennedy, and this was the anniversary of this address was a few days ago. So
Reverend Mazza, Reverend Rock,
I'm grateful for your generous invitation to state my views. While the so-called religious issue is necessarily and properly the chief topic here tonight, I want to emphasize from the outset that I believe that we have far more critical issues in the 1960 campaign. The spread of communist influence until it now festers only 90 miles from the coast of Florida. The humiliating treatment of our president and vice president by those who no longer respect our power. The hungry children I saw in West Virginia, the old people who cannot pay their doctor's bills, the families forced to give up their farms, and America with too many slums, with too few schools, and too late to the moon and outer space. These are the real issues which should decide this campaign. And they are not religious issues for war and hunger and ignorance and despair. No religious barrier. But because I am a Catholic, and no Catholic has ever been elected president, the real issues in this campaign have been obscured, perhaps deliberately, in some quarters less responsible than this. So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him, or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been, and may someday be again, a Jew or a Quaker or a Unitarian or a Baptist. It was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers, for example, that led to Jefferson's statute of religious freedom. Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you. Until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped apart at a time of great national peril. Finally, I believe in an America where religious intolerance will someday end, where all men and all churches are treated as equals, where every man has the same right to attend or not to attend the church of his choice, where there is no Catholic vote, no anti-Catholic vote, no block voting of any kind, and where Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, at both the lay and the pastoral levels, will refrain from those attitudes of disdain and division, which have so often marred their works in the past, and promote instead the American ideal of brotherhood. That is the kind of America in which I believe.
and it represents the kind of presidency in which I believe. A great office that must be neither humbled by making it the instrument of any religious group, nor tarnished by arbitrarily withholding it, its occupancy from the members of any one religious group. I believe in a president whose views on religion are his own private affair, neither imposed upon him by the nation, nor imposed by the nation upon him as a condition to holding that office. I would not look with favor upon a president working to subvert the First Amendment's guarantees of religious liberty, nor would our system of checks and balances permit him to do so. And neither do I look with favor upon those who would work to subvert Article 6 of the Constitution by requiring a religious test, even by indirection. For if they disagree with that safeguard, they should be openly working to repeal it. I want a chief executive whose public acts are responsible to all and obligated to none, who can attend any ceremony, service, or dinner his office may appropriately require him to fulfill, and whose fulfillment of his presidential office is not limited or conditioned by any religious oath, ritual, or obligation. This is the kind of America I believe in, and this is the kind of America I fought for in the South Pacific, and the kind my brother died for in Europe. No one suggested then that we might have a divided loyalty, that we did not believe in liberty, or that we belonged to a disloyal group that threatened, I quote, the freedoms for which our forefathers died. And in fact, this is the kind of America for which our forefathers did die, when they fled here to escape religious test oaths that denied office to members of less favored churches, when they fought for the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, and when they fought at the shrine I visited today, the Alamo. For side by side with Bowie and Crockett died Fuentes and McCafferty and Bailey and Bedillo and Carey, but no one knows whether they were Catholics or not, for there was no religious test there. I ask you tonight to follow in that tradition, to judge me on the basis of 14 years in the Congress, on my declared stands against an ambassador to the Vatican, against unconstitutional aid to parochial schools, and against any boycott of the public schools, which I attended myself. And instead of doing this, do not judge me on the basis of these pamphlets and publications. We have all seen that carefully select quotations out of context from the statements of Catholic Church leaders, usually in other countries, frequently in other centuries, and rarely relevant to any situation here, and always omitting, of course, the statement of the American bishops in 1948, which strongly endorsed church-state separation, and which more nearly reflects the views of almost every American Catholic. I do not consider these other quotations binding upon my public acts. Why should you? But let me say, with respect to other countries, that I am wholly opposed to the state being used by any religious group, Catholic or Protestant, to compel, prohibit, or prosecute the free exercise of any other religion. And that goes for any persecution at any time by anyone in any country. And I hope that you and I condemn with equal fervor those nations which deny their presidency to Protestants and those which deny it to Catholics. And rather than cite the misdeeds of those who differ, I would also cite the record of the Catholic Church in such nations as France and Ireland, and the independence of such statesmen as de Gaulle and Adenauer. But let me stress again that these are my views. For contrary to common newspaper usage, I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic Party's candidate for president, who happens also to be a Catholic. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me. Whatever issue may come before me as president, if I should be elected, on birth control, divorce, censorship, gambling, or any other subject, I will make my decision in accordance with these views, in accordance with what my conscience tells me to be in the national interest, and without regard to outside religious pressure or dictates. And no power or threat of punishment could cause me to decide otherwise. But if the time should ever come, and I do not concede any conflict to be remotely possible, when my office would require me to either violate my conscience or violate the national interest, then I would resign the office, and I hope any other conscientious public servant would do likewise. But I do not intend to apologize for these views to my critics of either Catholic or Protestant faith, nor do I intend to disavow either my views or my church in order to win this election. If I should lose on the real issues, I shall return to my seat in the Senate, satisfied that I tried my best and was fairly judged. But if this election is decided on the basis that 40 million Americans lost their chance of being president on the day they were baptized, then it is the whole nation that will be the loser in the eyes of Catholics and non-Catholics around the world, in the eyes of history, and in the eyes of our own people. But if, on the other hand, I should win this election, then I shall devote every effort of mind and spirit to fulfilling the oath of the presidency, practically identical, I might add, with the oath I have taken for 14 years in the Congress. For without reservation, I can, and I quote, solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, so help me God.
And yes, that was John Kennedy talking about the essentially the separation of church and state. And back in, this was September 1962, I believe, or 1961. Yesterday, Friday, Paul Manafort agreed to cooperate with the special counsel, Robert Mueller. He pled guilty to reduced charges, so essentially he reached a plea deal that could possibly shape in the final stages of the inquiry into the Russia interference in the 2016 presidential election. And according to the deal, was a surrender by Mr. Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman, who had vowed for months to I'm reading an article by the New York Times, written by Sharon Lafreniere and Kenneth P. Vogel. The deal was a surrender by Mr. Manafort, according to the article, who had vowed for months to prove his innocence in a case stemming from his work as a political consultant in Ukraine, and it was a decisive triumph for Robert Mueller, who now has a cooperating witness who was at the center of the Trump campaign during a crucial period in 2016 and has detailed insight into another target of federal prosecutors, the network of lobbyists and influence brokers seeking to help foreign interests in Washington. Mr. Manafort's decision, announced at a federal court hearing in Washington, in which he pleaded guilty to two conspiracy charges, was likely to unsettle Mr. Trump, who had praised Mr. Manafort for standing up to prosecutors and had, quote, hinted that he might pardon him. It's not clear to what information Mr. Manafort offered prosecutors in 3 days of negotiations that led to the plea deal, but in court on Friday, Mr. Manafort agreed to an open-ended arrangement that requires him to answer fully, truthfully, completely, and forthrightly questions about any and all matters the government wants to ask about the president's personal lawyer, his current lawyer, he's gone through a couple lawyers, Rudolph W. Giuliani, quickly sought to distance Mr. Trump from the plea deal. Once again, and this is a quote from, I believe, Giuliani, once again, an investigation has concluded with a plea having nothing to do with the president, with President Trump or the Trump campaign. He said in a statement, quote, "The reason the president did nothing wrong and Paul Manafort will tell the truth." Mr. Mueller's investigation has maintained such, and this is more of the article, this is not a quote. Mr. Mueller's investigation has maintained such secrecy that it is impossible to know what puzzle pieces he might still be trying to fill in, or what Mr. Manafort's testimony might mean for President Trump, but at a minimum, Mr. Manafort's cooperation gives Robert Mueller additional visibility in some key moments in the campaign and the role of other senior figures. And Mr. Manafort was a participant in the June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower that had been arranged by a Moscow lawyer who said she was delivering damaging information about Hillary Clinton on the Kremlin's behalf. His cooperation could help Mr. Mueller establish how much, if anything, the Trump campaign knew about Russia's efforts to boost Mr. Trump's candidacy. And of course, Paul Manafort joins four other Trump aides who have offered cooperation in exchange for lesser charges in cases that Mr. Mueller's office either pursued or referred to federal prosecutors in New York. They include Michael Cohen, the president's longtime personal lawyer, Michael T. Flynn, the former national security advisor, Rick Gates, the former deputy campaign chairman, and George Papadopoulos, a former campaign advisor. And Kevin Downing, this is another quote from Manafort's lawyer, said it was, quote, "a tough day for Mr. Manafort, but he has accepted responsibility for criminal conduct that dates back many years. He wanted to make sure his family was able to remain safe and live a good life." And yeah, so this has been obviously an ongoing case, and it still is obviously ongoing with the investigation by the FBI. So yeah, it's been quite the week in news. And of course, with the Hurricane Florence, which has been downgraded to a tropical storm, but that unfortunately it's been hitting parts of specifically the South North Carolina. And this is a quote, another New York Times article I'm reading by Jack Healy and Sherry Flunk. But essentially, FEMA said that it's more than 1,000 workers in the Carolinas, and the Coast Guard says ships and search and rescue crews at the ready. Tennessee has sent firefighters and swift water rescue specialists, and Maryland said it would send helicopter aquatic rescue team. So yeah, it's been a very so far on since on Friday, more than 385 people have been rescued from the city of New Bern. It's been kind of been a very hard week with the, of course, hurricane and tropical storms. So far, at least 6 deaths have been reported from the flooding, and nearly a million people from the east and kind of south coast have been reported without power. And it was considered a Category 1 hurricane when it hit Wilmington, North Carolina, early Friday. Then it was downgraded to a tropical storm hours later, and the damage of the first blow along the coast, which, while not as bad, it still has had obviously created a lot of damage, and but winds of 50 miles per hour, and it's created a lot of flooding problems there in South Carolina and North Carolina. So it's So kind of just want to give an update on that. And of course, September 13th also marks the anniversary of Archbishop Desmond Tutu leading an anti-apartheid protest march in South Africa. It was September 13th, 1999. I'm kind of transitioning here, this is a kind of a speech I wanted to play on by Archbishop Desmond Tutu on apartheid, and I believe he also talks about apartheid in South Africa, and he talks about Nelson Mandela. So this is Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Let's go to hear another important black voice. We're joined briefly this morning by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa. Archbishop Tutu, thank you for taking a few minutes. Is Mr. Mandela now the universally recognized leader of the black nationalist movement in your country?
I have to say, he's just been behaving wonderfully well. And we have kept saying that he is head and shoulders above any other leader, black or white, in South Africa. He has never claimed to be the universal leader of all blacks. You heard in his speech that their commitment is to a multi-party democracy, which does mean that there will be place for any other people who have constituencies that seek to choose them to represent them.
You, sir, have made much over your quite brilliant career of the need to get rid of violence, to expunge violence from the struggle. And you hear Mr. Mandela in the United States saying it is still necessary. Does that make you uncomfortable?
Well, of course, our position is one that is quite clear and consistent, that we are quite firmly opposed to all forms of violence. But when you hear the kind of evidence that comes before the Harams Commission, the Heemstra Commissions, which are talking about the nefarious activities of agents of the system who have had death squads and hit lists, then you realize that our country is still very firmly violent, and the basic violence is the violence of apartheid. But we have already, as a synod of bishops in our church, made a call to the ANC that as the political business becomes more normalized, they ought to consider at the very least suspending the armed struggle and getting as quickly as possible into the negotiating mode.
I apologize for reducing you to the level of mere journalist or reporter, Archbishop, but tell us how this is playing in the press down there. It's getting enormous attention in America. What about on South African television and in the newspapers?
I gather that the quite fabulous reception that he got in New York was not shown on SABC TV. I was away from the country. But the newspapers have been giving very great play. One of the newspapers in Johannesburg had on its front page after the ticker tape parade, Mandela Superstar, in banner headlines. And I think that on the whole, it has been getting very good coverage. Some of the newspapers, of course, have been...
We were afraid that might happen. I apologize for that. We knew that we were going to lose the satellite to South Africa at some point, but that is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa.
News anchor said that was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and I just would like to thank, I forgot to give credit to Trevor, the YouTube channel Trevor Dawson, for having that video and audio available. Also, I forgot to give credit to the YouTube channel Soraba, if I'm pronouncing that correct, for the JFK Church and State video and audio, so thank you for having that available. I will like to play another little bit more audio speech address from Desmond Tutu. This is from One Young World's YouTube channel. So thank you for having this audio available. And this is Archbishop Desmond Tutu addressing the One Young World opening ceremony.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's fantastic to be here. Good evening. Oh, that's lousy. Hello. Well, despite all appearances to the contrary, I am old. A few years ago, they named a school after me in the Netherlands. That's not the important thing. The school was celebrating its 400th anniversary, and my wife and I went to this little village in Holland, and when we arrived, a little girl came up to me and said, "Were you here when the school started?" I thought I knew I was decrepit, but not quite that decrepit. Well, why have I come? I have come actually because it is a very great privilege for me. And the privilege is, I want to salute you, for you are a fantastic bunch of human beings. I mean, you have amongst you people who are already leaders. The youngest racing pilot. You have a young man who is going to be the youngest to walk to the Arctic North Pole. Gee! It's cold here. I don't know what it would be like there. And then you gave a warm clap for someone who survived the Haiti disaster. You have some people here who are already investment bankers. Fantastic. And I come to salute you. I come because young people are such a fantastic group of people. You dream dreams of a world that is without war. You dream dreams and you say, let us make poverty history. And I get very upset with you media, you know. I get very upset with you because you go around telling people what is only part of the truth. You say, just look at these young people who go off the rails. Of course there are young people who do go off the rails. But it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, when I was growing up, the only drug they had around was marijuana. What about today? You young people are exposed to some of the most horrendous things. Cocaine, all of those rough stuff, man. Hey. And you are people who are exposed to some of the most awful, pressured advertising. They tell you, if you want to be cool, man, you got to buy this, you got to buy the other, you got to buy. And when I was growing up, we didn't have internet. And I'm told, I'm told there are some extraordinary things you can see on the internet. Oi, 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 oi. I don't know. I haven't seen them. I have been told. And what happens? Young people like yourselves are exposed to all of these pressures. What ought to surprise us is not that some young people succumb and go off the rails. What should be surprising us? What should be making us say, yee, they really are fantastic, is that so many don't. And I've visited a number of poor countries, and in remote villages, I found young people who come from opulent places, working away hidden, teaching schools in poor, remote villages. You guys, you don't tell the world about them. You don't tell the world about those kids who use a gap year and say, I'm not going to go to university this year. I want to be able to do something, and they go off and are volunteers. You don't tell us about those kids. Hello? Hello? Do you? Do you? No! You ought to! You ought to tell the world that these young people dream dreams. They dream the dream of God. I was in Copenhagen, and most of the people who were demonstrating there, who were passionate, were young people. 100,000 young people went out on the streets of Copenhagen, and I can tell you, it wasn't what. It was but they were out there. Hey, you oldies. Why don't you care about carbon emissions? Hey, you oldies. The ice is melting in the Arctic. The polar bears are drowning. It's happening. The sea level is rising. There are islands now that risk being submerged. We're not talking theory. Please, old people, it's real. Young people. And it's quite amazing. You know, God has been using young people from the year dot. Joseph, David kills a big Goliath. Francis of Assisi. And then you. God is going to be using you to say to us, oldies, hey, when are you going to get it into your head? Just look at how much you are spending on guns. Look at how much you are spending when a very, very, very small fraction of your budgets of death would ensure that children everywhere in the world had clean water to drink, had enough food to eat, had a decent home. I mean, we oldies have got the world. I mean, how many wars have we started? They were not started by young people. And most of those who started the wars, you think you'll find them on the front line? No, no, no. They are sitting comfortably at home and watching other people's children die. So I come to you and say, hey, just go on being idealistic. Just go on dreaming that we are going to have a different kind of world than the one that we are leaving you. Well, when we have when we come back, I mean, we may be ghosts when we come back, but I mean, when we come back and we look at what you have done, what would you be surprised? What would you see a world, hey, there's no longer any poverty. There's no longer any hunger. There's no longer any war. Hey, you are going to make this a beautiful, beautiful world. You know what? As I look around, I can see, yeah. I can see Nobel Peace Laureates around here. I look around and I see. A few years ago, I was with a group of fellow Nobel Laureates and we were with a group of about 3,000 young people, and they asked, what does it take to become a peace laureate? I said, oh, no, that's very simple, man, very simple. It takes three things. You must have an easy name. Tutu. And you must have a large nose. And because we were in Bali, it was very warm, and I was wearing shorts. And I said, the third thing that you need is a pair of sexy legs. Well, what was I saying? Nobel laureates don't fall ready-made from heaven. They are ordinary human beings. Where is Yunus? Muhammad Yunus, where are you? There. and so I look around and I see some fantastic things, man. I see you are people who are going to make this a beautiful world. And you are going to put a smile on the face of Bob Geldof. I'm trying to get him to comb his hair. He's a lovely guy. I love you, man. You are a fantastic guy. But you, I want to ask you to do me just one little favor. I think you are fantastic. And I want to clap you. But if I clap you all by myself, people will say, we always thought, no, not. So, please join me in clapping some of the most fantastic human beings in the world. You, come on, join. Thank you.
That was Desmond Tutu addressing the One Young World delegates at the Young World ceremony. And so thank you to One Young World's YouTube channel for having that audio available. Some public service announcements I wanted to get to. Did you know that you can host a party at Urbana Park District facilities? The Anita Purves Nature Center and the Urbana Indoor Aquatic Center rent out space for people of all ages. For the little ones, the Nature Center offers parties with a nature theme, and kids always have fun swimming inside at Urbana Indoor Aquatic Center. For more information about how to rent Park District facilities for a party, you can call 217-367-1544. Again, that's 217-367-1544. That one's gone. And of course, you can bring your friends and family to here at WEFT. We're having WEFT Fest, which you can bring your friends and family to our annual street party on Sunday, September 16th. So that's tomorrow. That's starting at 1 and it goes all 1 p.m. all the way to 6 p.m. As usual, it'll be in the Seven Saints Beer Garden on North Market Street, right next to WEFT Station. You'll hear some great local music and have some free birthday cake, too. Seven Saints will sell additional food and drinks. CDs, vinyl, and WEFT t-shirts will be available for purchase. Performers include Paul Kothheimer, Gloria Rubel, and Akila, also, which these were just added, Bali Latari, if I'm pronouncing that right, Gameland World Music, and Kittens Incorporated. Times are posted at weft.org or weft.org. And great raffle prizes will include a guitar from the Upper Bout, gift cards and baskets from lots of local businesses. And again, that's tomorrow, September 16th, Sunday, right here on North Market Street, starting at 1 p.m. Don't miss it. Let's see. Art theater listings for the week of this week, starting yesterday, going all the way to Thursday, September 20th. Screening daily is The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which follows the Cameron and her newly made friends as they fight their way through life in a gay conversion therapy center. This weekend's late night movie, plus noon on Sunday and Wednesday, Marlena, the murder in four acts. When a young widow is raped and her cattle are stolen, she fights back and embarks on a journey of redemption and empowerment. Also playing is Madeline is anchored by a virtuoso, attention-grabbing performances by Helena Howard. Writer Josephine Decker's film displays a sensitive hand while capturing the struggles of teenage self-discovery. Playing Monday, September 17th, is Fanny and Alexander as part of the Arts Bergman in Three Acts, a Centennial series. This Academy Award-winning film was Bergman's swan song, combining his trademarks of emotion and melancholy with joy and sensuality. And an exploration of the music that helped launch Beatlemania, Deconstructing the Beatles, 1963, will screen on Tuesday, September 18th. And for all up-to-date times, for up-to-date dates and times, you can visit the Art Theater's website, www.theartheater.org or .org. And of course, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And with the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings, there was a kind of a big story that came out. A woman has accused the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of assaulting her when they were in high school in the early 1980s, according to a source familiar with the allegations, which were relayed in a letter to Senator Dianne Feinstein earlier this summer. And this is an article I'm reading on CNN by Ariane DeVoig and Phil Mattingly. They're journalists for CNN. This woman is accusing that Kavanaugh assaulted her at a party a party that in high school, this would have been the around the early 1980s. And yeah, there's no indication that this woman reported the incident to law enforcement at the time, but she said she received medical treatment regarding the alleged assault. And the woman also, this woman has declined to come forward publicly after sending, she sent this letter to Dianne Feinstein, who is the senator from California. Kavanaugh has denied the allegation, saying that, quote, "I categorically and unequivocally deny this allegation. I did not do this back in high school or at any time." And Kavanaugh has testified for 3 days before the Senate Judiciary. He has testified for 3 days before the Senate Judiciary Committee during last week. The issue was not raised during the during those 3 days. The judiciary panel is scheduled to consider Kavanaugh's nomination next Thursday, and the full Senate will possibly vote on confirming Brett Kavanaugh later this month. Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, the Republican from Iowa, does not plan to postpone the vote, saying, quote, "The Senate Judiciary Committee will vote on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. We'll proceed as scheduled next Thursday." That was a quote from spokesman George Hartman he was a spokesman for Chuck Grassley. And these details of the woman accusing Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault were reported by the New Yorker. The New Yorker got the details of the letter, and I believe it was Jane Mayer and it was a piece from the New Yorker by those accusations came about. I'll keep up to date on what happens with the Supreme Court nomination process with Brett Kavanaugh. It's also a Pride weekend here. We're also celebrating Pride weekend here at WEFT, and I would like to play a speech by Harvey Milk. This is his Give Them Hope speech, and I'll play that for you. This is G. McGarity YouTube channel, so thank you for having this audio, G. McGarity, and this is Give Them Hope, an excerpt of Harvey Milk's Give Them Hope speech.
Somewhere in Des Moines or San Antonio, there's a young gay person who all of a sudden realizes that she or he is gay, knows that if the parents find out, they'll be tossed out of the house. The classmates would taunt the child, and the Anita Bryans and John Briggs are doing their bit on TV, and that child had several options: staying in a closet, suicide, and then one day that child might open a paper and it says homosexual elected in San Francisco, and there are two new options. The option is to go to California. Stay in San Antonio and fight. 2 days after I was elected, I got a phone call, and the voice was quite young. It was from Altoona, Pennsylvania, and the person said, "Thanks, and you've got to elect gay people so that that young child and the thousands upon thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world. There's hope for a better tomorrow. without hope, not only gays, but those blacks and the Asians, and the disabled, and the seniors, the usses, without hope, the usses give up. I know that you cannot live on hope alone, but without it, life is not worth living. And you, you've got to give them hope. Thank you very much.
Yes, and that was, again, Harvey Milk's kind of excerpt, or I don't know if it was his whole speech, but about give them hope kind of speech. Ronan Farrow was the other reporter that with the accusation against Brett Kavanaugh. That was from The New Yorker about the accusations that were brought to Senator Dianne Feinstein against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. I'm going to play just a little bit of kind of going back a little bit in history, if I have time. Well, actually, I probably don't. I don't think I will have time. Just kind of a we at WEFT here were recently informed of an issue. I'm going to read one more PSA. We at WEFT were recently informed of an issue with our broadcast tower. To stay on air, we are making plans to relocate our antenna and transmitter in the next few months, costing approximately $50,000. This is an unanticipated expense that approaches our annual budget. If you are interested in helping to keep this community treasure operational, you can do many different ways. First, you can join WEFT and as an individual member here at weft.org. If you have a business, you could become an underwriter of WEFT programming. If you know any possible grants or other types of funding, share that information with us, or even partner with WEFT on your next fundraiser. WEFT can provide people power and free promotion. And for more information, you can send an email to stationmanager@weft.org. No, and as always, stay tuned to 90.1 FM. I believe it was Tuesday, marked the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, and essentially started what eventually led us into the war in Afghanistan, which now is entering. Its 17th anniversary. I wanted to kind of play a quote on essentially, kind of about war and looking forward and trying not to be too cynical since we're in this, I suppose you would say, post 9/11. World we live in now. So this is a quote by this is a part of Martin Luther King's I Refuse speech. Well, actually, that wasn't what I was hoping it would be. I was hoping it would be actually Martin Luther King speaking, but I'll just read the quote by Martin Luther King. I refuse to accept, this is just an excerpt of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. And also, funny enough, on September 11th, Benjamin Franklin wrote the, this was an excerpt that Benjamin Franklin wrote, this was on September 11th, 1783, that, Benjamin Franklin wrote, I believe this was a meeting in Paris, and, this is a quote from Benjamin Franklin. "May we never see another war. In my opinion, there never was a good war or a bad peace." But I will end that here on The World We Live In. Again, please join us here at WEFT for WEFT Pride Fest. We will have a booth. And I'm going to end or play out a song by Cyndi Lauper. This is True Colors by Cyndi Lauper. Enjoy the rest of your day.
But I see your true colors shining through.